So again, Mayor Grimm, thank you for coming into the station this morning for this, what we used to call our regular segment called City Talk. So we'll be hopefully seeing you on a regular basis, maybe every 6 weeks or something like that, or every 2 months to get an update. We'll just get right to it. You took office in early January this year, and you're now 6 months into your four-year term as mayor of Sandpoint. I'm sure you have a lot to report, but let's just say, how's it going? How was the transition? Are you settling in? And what can you report on all of that?
Thanks. Yes, it's going well. 6 months, into a four-year term. And when I ran for office, I had some pretty clear priorities of what I hope to achieve. I feel like at this point we are making some pretty good progress on all of those. The big thing is, the organizational restructuring. When I came into office on January 4th, I had 17 direct reports, which is how the former city administrator is running the organization. So that means you're like in meetings constantly all day long, like literally meeting to meeting to meeting to meeting. And right now, thanks to some hires and promotions, I've restructured the city back to its former organizational structure, which was a department head-led organization. So right now I'm down to 7 direct reports, which are department heads. That would be finance, police, fire, community planning and development, central services, attorney, and public works director. So what that does, it allows me to now go in 3 days a week, truly a part-time job now, instead of 5 days a week, and meet with those department heads individually on Tuesdays, and then collectively as a group on Wednesdays. And then the rest of the 3 days that I'm there, I'm either responding to citizen concerns, signing documents, payroll, time cards, things like that. So that's gone really well. The next priority I had was our water system. If the public's not aware, our wastewater treatment plant is at the end of its useful life. We actually just had a settlement with the EPA for violating E. coli discharge into the river. So this is a big deal for everyone who likes the river or likes clean water. And we just were able to hire an engineer yesterday. We had a whole day of interviews, selection for an engineer that will create our preliminary engineering report for the cost estimate and the treatment technology that will be our new wastewater treatment plant. We will have that this January, going into all the state and federal agencies, and we will probably be then looking for the voters to approve a very large bond to allow us to go into debt to build that plant. So that will probably come before the voters in May. So those two things are going very well. The next priority I had was certainly our roads. Our roads are horrific. We can talk about that in a little bit in more detail. And then, of course, in terms of initial sort of onboarding, it's just been great. The staff's been wonderful. We had some departures, and we've backfilled all those positions. So it feels like a very functional, spirited team at City Hall. And I feel like we've made some big improvements to the transparency. If you've observed, at city council meetings, those department heads are now presenting their weekly reports or bi-monthly reports. And that really, in my mind, is critical. It allows the city council to ask questions. It allows the public to hear everything that's on the radar. And what it prevents is an individual position narrating and setting the tone and selectively exposing information. So it's raw, it's real, and any questions at city council can come up, and that's the way I think it should be.
So with the department head structure you've created, I assume you're assuming you're vesting more authority and responsibility into those positions?
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. I get it. Those first 4 months, I was making every decision, as I presume the former city administrator was making. Literally, every decision. Nothing happened without going to a meeting and saying, can I do this? So, I mean, that's great. In some sense, you have total control. So going with the department heads, it's like taking your hands off the wheel with, I've never done it, but an autopilot car, right? You are trusting those folks to make good decisions. But these people that I've put in place here, they are experts in their fields, they are accountable, and they can make decisions. And my hope is that by elevating that decision-making process, that the public will be served better, because you won't have to wait a week or two or three for someone to come back and say, oh, I checked with the head person. They can now make those decisions on a daily basis. And that's a little bit, you know, frightening to some degree, because obviously that comes with great latitude. Those department heads may have different views or opinions or ideas than I might, but that just comes with the territory, and some of those views and opinions are probably better than what I would have. So, I'm really, really encouraged by the setup that we have right now. Mm-hmm.
So the idea is to hire really qualified professionals as your department heads. Do you have those folks in place now in all the departments?
We have them all in place except for a public works director. Mm-hmm. We are currently using a recruiter right now. The current economy, the growth, it's very competitive to find a individual with that qualification. So we tried to do it internally. I was trying to save some money and just advertise locally and on the national websites. We've gone back to a recruiter, and they are actively, you know, seeking people for that position. So we hope to have that filled within 2 months, I would guess.
When you talk about giving more authority to these seven department heads, a lot of times it's clear mandates, it's policies and procedures that guide them in that free and ability to make decisions. How has that changed? Have you had to clarify those mandates and policies and procedures so that they know that when they make a decision, they're basically supported?
Yeah, great question. The city does have a strategic plan that if you go to the city's website, City of Sandpoint, sandpointid.gov, I believe it is. Oh, I should know that. When you go to the website, you can find our strategic plan. It's pretty high level, and here's how I've approached it. I've gone to them all, and I've said, listen, we have lacked investment in our infrastructure, in our parks, in our roads, in our water, in our sewer for more than 10 years. It's in a state of criticality. I mean, it is fragile. So I said, anywhere you're spending, anything you're doing, think first about taking care of what we have first before looking at big, bright, shiny new projects. So what that means locally is, like, how can we address, parking issues easier, like by painting curbs red? Pretty simple solution. From the higher level parks and rec, you know, can we paint and weed and take care of City Beach and our other parks and focus the efforts there? So what we have functions and represents, you know, the values of Sandpoint. So, they've had a pretty clear direction that this is a period of austerity, so to speak. We are focusing on what we have and not looking at big, fancy, dreamy projects.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like the one big, not dreamy project is the wastewater. Yeah. It's mandatory.
You know, it's mandatory, and it's critical. This is a fun story. We had about seven engineering firms come up to tour to bid on this engineering opportunity. And one of them left and said, we are going to nominate Devin Hull, your plant operator, as operator of the year for the country. Because most modern plants, you have the ability to push buttons and turn keys to stop things if there is some kind of critical problem. Like a year and a half ago when a pipe ruptured and raw sewage almost filled the basin and flowed into the river. Devin doesn't have those opportunities. So he's literally flying without a net and without a parachute. He and his team are down there, unfortunately, just with, you know, baling wire and duct tape and bubble gum, putting this thing together on a daily basis. It's a World War II era plant, and we've known this for decades. And, you know, it's come time to address this issue for the people who depend on the water and recreate on the water and for our citizens. So.
So the wastewater violations, you mentioned specifically E. coli, is that due to the stormwater treatment?
It is. It does tie into stormwater. For the listeners who may be new to the area, Sandpoint sits on about 300 feet of clay. The water does not percolate and go downward, like maybe on the Rathdrum Prairie or down in Coeur d'Alene where they sit on a bunch of cobble and gravel. So when we get rain on snow events, April, May, you get rainwater, snow melt, it hits the soil, it does go down a little bit, but then it's looking for those pathways towards down gradient or towards the lake. And often those pathways are in the trenches where our sewer lines are. And those sewer lines are old, they have cracks, they have gaps. So on a typical dry summer day, it takes about 9 hours for a drop of sewage to go through the plant, hit the plant, go through the clarifiers, the digesters, and the disinfection. So 9 hours during a rain on snow event, sometimes because there's so much water coming through, it may take 40 minutes. So Devin just has to open everything wide open and let it go through, else it would overflow the plant. Mm. So in that case, there's not enough time to disinfect and treat the water. And we do get E. coli violations, which we all know what E. coli comes from and is. And it's very dangerous and it's not acceptable. So we need to, you know, as we build up to this wastewater plant bond, we need to make sure that the public understands this isn't some discretionary project. This is a critical piece of infrastructure that allows the city to run.
Mm-hmm. Any idea how much that bond is going to go for when we get around to that? You mentioned that might be coming up in May.
Yeah, it will undoubtedly be the largest public works project in Bonner County history, mm-hmm. Outside of ITD roads. So our initial, depending on the treatment technology, we had a 2019 assessment done. They thought between 60 and 100 million. We all know there's been inflation since 2019, so it would not surprise me if this came in above $100 million. It is significant, and I guess as we approach this, the one thing I'd say is there's a lot of treatment technologies out there, and I have directed the engineers to look at tried and true treatment technologies. I don't want to gamble the public's money on some new whiz-bang technology. So it's going to be a fairly traditional type of plant, probably with chlorine treatment, disinfection, maybe ultraviolet. But it's going to be a tried, tested, and, you know, proven product. But one of the big challenges is it's going to be located in the same place as our existing wastewater plant. I've directed that because if you imagine trying to site a new wastewater facility, just think back on how disruptive it was to site a tennis facility or pickleball facility. I don't want to go down that route. So for that and other reasons, the existing location makes a lot of sense. As we proceed, it's like changing tires on a car as you're driving down the highway. The plant has to operate during this whole time that they are actually rebuilding it. Maybe more like changing the wings on an airplane as you're flying. So it's very complicated. It's a fairly tight footprint, but most of the new technology uses far less area and is much more compact. So the odors will be almost eliminated, and aesthetically, you won't see, you know, big, you know, spurting fountains of sewage out there. So
you won't need to expand the footprint because no. There's some room. I mean, you'd have to eat into Lakeview Park, I presume.
Right. No, we don't want to expand the footprint. Yeah. We've got all the old growth cedar next to the arboretum. We've got the pickleball. So based on initial layouts, it looks like they have plenty of room to to build in a system that will take us at least 20 to 30 years in the future.
So an internal system with better and newer technology.
Yes. Yeah. That technology, again, is World War II. It came, many of those parts came from Farragut, you know, which was the Naval Reserve base down there. So, Yes, we're going to hopefully step into the 21st century here.
Well, at least we got our money's worth out of it, I guess. You could say.
You know, it's a good question because now I approve every single bill that comes through the city above a certain dollar amount, and you see the daily bills for repair. And our treatment plant operators are literally going to North 40 and buying RV sewer pipe and like duct taping it and connecting it with clamps. Mm. I mean, it's a train wreck. And, you know, it's something that's been swept under the carpet for far too long. Mm.
Are you seeing through the work in the city a lot of support? Well, support for this new project and the bond that will be coming up? Because obviously most people, we're hearing now how it's not a choice, it's a mandate, and it's a critical one.
Yeah, so you know, we haven't really started this. It's going to be in May. We're just getting the engineering done, so we know the cost. Mm-hmm. We'll be going to our congressional delegation asking for, you know, set aside dollars. We'll be going to Idaho DEQ. There's the state revolving loan, some EPA funding. So we're getting funding. The good news is that we have raised rates in the last few years. So we have sufficient revenue to support the bonds. We won't have to raise rates. I believe there's one more rate increase built into that plan. So we have the revenue, and then we'll go and shake the trees and get funding to backfill. Some communities are lucky enough to get up to 50% grant and low interest loans on these. So we'll try to do everything we can to keep those rates low. But the wastewater plant's just one of our deficiencies. Our roads are another huge challenge. I don't know if you need to take a break, but
I had a follow-up question on the waste, because the city is growing, our community is growing, the whole outer area to North Idaho. And how will this new treatment plant and our water use too, you know, where we get our clean water, meet the needs of the growth that's in front of us?
So that's a great question. I guess what I'd say is, you know, my philosophy is to focus on Sandpoint. A lot of things such as the fire districts and the joint powers agreement, they kind of bleed over into the broader Bonner County area. And one of the things that's amazing about our system of government is that if needed, right now I can make 4 phone calls to 4 council members, and we could have an emergency meeting, and we can make a decision on anything, 5 of us. That's amazing. We have autonomy and the responsibility for the people and our residents and business in Sandpoint. Once you start bleeding over into, you know, consolidation and regionalization, you start to lose the ability to be able to make those decisions without having to go into another entity and saying, okay, we've made our decision, you go make your decision. Oh, and then now you go have your meeting. So the reason I bring that up is the system we're designing is specific for Sandpoint and Sandpoint's growth. Our water system has sufficient capacity for Sandpoint proper. The public may not know, but we also serve water outside of the city limits. We serve to Syringa, we serve to Northside, we serve to Ponderay, to Kootenai, and to Ponder Point. So we serve a variety of other cities and regional county land. That's my third priority, if you go back and look. Wastewater, roads, and water. So I can fully inform you of that issue any way you want to tackle it. But the water problem is we have deficiencies in our what we call fire flows, a little bit in Sandpoint proper, but more so in Ponderay, Ponder Point, Kootenai, and Syringa and elsewhere. So when there's deficiencies in fire flows, when you go to issue a new building permit for a house or a hotel or an industry, you have to prove that if there's a fire and they open that fire pipe, you know, there's going to be pressure. So because of those deficiencies, we need probably between $15 and $20 million of pipe upgrading outside of Sandpoint. So in Ponderay, Ponder Point, and Kootenai. Now, because it's the Sandpoint Utility Water System, which the council is the board of, we would have to go into debt to go upgrade the pipes in another city. And to do that, we'd have to go out for a bond. And it puts us in a challenging position where our voters would have to vote to go into debt to upgrade the pipes in a an adjacent city, something I think is probably unlikely to pass. So my goal on all of that, this next year of my term, we will be working with water district experts, water right experts, premium legal counsel, sitting down with Mayor Geiger, the mayor of Kootenai, and other users. And we are going to try to figure out how do I decouple Sandpoint from serving water as a metered provider to transitioning where Sandpoint would just be a master wholesaler of water. Basically, we put a big meter on the city boundary, sell them as much water as we can, they want, but they would become responsible for their pipes, their infrastructure, their improvements, the hookups, the design, the meter reading, all of that. So that's my goal on the water, is to, again, bring it back to just Sandpoint, where we can control what we can control, which is within our city limits.
So to clarify, Sandpoint provides the water for Pondere, Dover, Kootenai.
Not Dover.
Okay. They have their own water system.
Yes.
But are Pondere and Kootenai reliant on our source of water?
Yes.
Entirely right now. So yes. They'd have to set up their own water system if they wanted to not go along with, say, some kind of agreement with the city on that respect.
Yeah. Yeah, they would need a water source and a treatment system. And our plant, our lake water plant, has plenty of capacity. So, again, we would hopefully do something like a master meter on the city limits. Hopefully the council would be agreeable to giving Pondere and Kootenai all the water lines that are in the ground. There you go. They're yours. Mm-hmm. If you need them to be bigger, you pay for it. If you need them, if they break, you fix them. You get to charge water rates and hire staff to go read the meters and do the billing. Pondere pitches itself as the little city with the big future. Well,
this is part of the future.
Yeah, yeah. They're getting bigger. And
It's a city service. I mean, it's just standard city service.
And why Sandpoint Council should be involved in ultimately land use decisions by delivering water outside of our city limits, sometimes miles outside, is beyond me. Mm-hmm. If you're aware of the Providence Park subdivision out there by Seven Sisters in Kootenai, the city of Kootenai wanted them to annex into the city. Sandpoint provided water. And under the county zoning, with urban water, you can get those densities without annexing. So in that case, we had a subdivision pop up next to Kootenai that Kootenai wanted in the city. And we ended up serving water to them, which allowed
But the subdivision did not come into the city?
Correct.
Oh.
It did not come into the city.
Couldn't the Kootenai have made that a condition of providing?
No, because it's in Bonner County. Mm-hmm. So we also serve water in Bonner County, which means that falls under the county zoning districts.
Mm. It sounds like water treatment and water capacity is a big issue, and it does inform growth, not just here in Sandpoint, but outside, providing that clean water to other communities. And I think what you're describing will kind of alleviate some of the concerns here of citizens in Sandpoint that these other communities will be responsible, especially for upgrade.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. If you're not aware, in Bonner County, so once you leave a municipal boundary, if you have urban water and sewer, you can develop lots down to 20,000 square feet in most places. These are fairly small lots. So with those two services, coupled with land use that is permissive or very flexible on density, by providing those services, you're basically feeding gas to an industry and demand that could potentially, you could see Selly Valley turn into 20,000 square foot lots mm-hmm. with those services. So You know, I fundamentally believe that people moving to the area, people living here, should have a choice to live either in a urban center or in the country. That's fine. But we know that providing services in a more compact footprint, water, police, sewer, fire, EMS, is far more efficient in terms of delivery of services, lower taxes per unit served. So, you know, philosophically, I hope that the next 10,000 people who move here will have an opportunity to live in a more efficient, compact location or area, rather than having to go buy 5 acres, you know, out in the middle of Selly Valley or something.
Yeah, and it helps retain the rural character of the rural part of our county.
Absolutely.
Too. So I want the listeners to know that this is 88.5 KRFY. It's the morning show, and Chris Bessler and myself, Susie Prez, are here with the mayor of Sandpoint, Mayor Jeremy Grimm, and we're talking city talk, all kinds of things. And if you don't get to hear the whole interview, this will be on our website later in the day as a podcast at krfy.org.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's stay on the infrastructure talk, because let us know what's up with street maintenance.
Oh, boy.
It's a big issue. I mean, just driving around town, we got some streets that are in pretty bad shape. Even major streets like Pine or even Division. Yeah. There now, it's not just a pothole, it's a whole, it's like a, a several hundred yard long pothole on that, and along the right lane there.
Yeah, no, it's a challenge. It's the result of now going on probably 8 or 9 years with almost no investment in our streets, very minimal investment. There were other priorities. The former administration prioritized things like downtown waterfront design competitions and things like this. So it is what it is. You know, my wife tells me that, you know, I'm always trying to solve problems. If she's talking, she's like, I don't need a solution. Just want to talk and tell you where I'm at. So I'm solution oriented. So I see the streets. I look at the budget and I say, how the heck do we fix our streets? Roughly, it's you know, about $1 million to do a block of proper streets with curb, stormwater, proper base material. So we've got millions and millions of dollars of roads and streets in Sandpoint that, first of all, we're not built on proper base rock. As I mentioned before, we're sitting on 300 feet of clay here. So a lot of these streets were built when we were a very poor community, and they just put gravel and then put some asphalt on top of it. Well, if you've ever been on clay, quicksand, things sink. So every spring we get breakup and the roads literally sink into the ground. So we need base rock, we need stormwater. If you don't have proper stormwater in your streets, you get ponding and pooling of water during events. You get freeze and thaw. That water literally acts as a chisel cracking our streets. So we need stormwater design, and we need proper base material on our streets. Now, about 5 years ago, they did a pavement management study. They drove every street in Sandpoint with a laser on a truck, and it measured the roughness and the potholes and the cracks. We are below, on a scale of 1 to 100, we're below 50%. And those engineers estimated that if you spend $1 million a year on your streets, you will maintain where you are today. And if you don't spend that, you will continue to fall down the path of gravel roads. The voters may know that there was a resort city tax passed a couple years ago, which doubled our occupancy tax to 14%. That generates about $1 million a year that are dedicated to streets and sidewalks. But as I told you before, that's literally a drop in the bucket. So the reality in our streets, we will probably, I haven't informed the council. This is going to be news to some council members. Sorry for shocking you.
Breaking news, folks.
So Ponderay will be going out for a local option tax this fall, and I have decided to approach the council and seek their support to go out for a local option tax for our streets. Mm-hmm. If you're not aware, because we are a resort city, a population under 10,000, we have the ability to ask the voters to implement an extra tax
on retail sales. This would be a sales tax.
So
we had one a few years ago. It was a penny.
Memorial Field.
Yeah, one for penny. Memorial Field.
That's
yeah.
right. Mm-hmm. So the interesting thing is there's not a statute of limitations of what the duration of that tax can be. And I learned that, I believe it was Haley, Idaho, went out 35 years on theirs.
No kidding.
And the kicker is once you exceed 10,000 population at the next census, you're no longer eligible to have voters make that decision. So we lose the opportunity to go for a local option tax once we, in 2030, we'll likely lose that. So
with the next census, because right. we'll likely go over 10,000.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. So the thinking is that we go out for a local option tax, totally dedicated to streets. And my pledge to the residents and businesses of Sandpoint is if this gets passed, you will never have to drive on roads and streets that are in the condition they are today, because if we can get this passed for 25 years, this will be sufficient. It's about $1.6 million a year that it was generating when it was in place before. So the downside to it, and I'm going to be honest, it does tax groceries, which really sucks if you ask me. But that is the biggest sales category we have in Sandpoint. And looking at the old numbers, the grocery sales in the summertime, primarily from Super One and Safeway, they skyrocket. So we
from
know
out of town or
people, right?
Part-time right. residents.
So,
yeah.
We know that people from Bonner County shop at Safeway. So it's, I guess the upside is that we know that this tax would not just target Sandpoint residents. It would be spread out amongst visitors, Bonner County residents, and other users. So that's the plan. That's the only, because at the end of the day, we have, after we pay our payroll and health insurance at the city, the general fund, which is our property tax revenue, it leaves us less than $100,000 a year. So the city does not have buckets of money to put into streets, and that's what it takes.
You said that currently, there's about $1 million a year that's put into streets.
Correct.
And so would that be on top
yes.
and added to the 1.6 or whatever that yep. revenue that local option tax yeah. brings in?
Right. That's
and
correct.
As the city grows, that might increase
that's,
too.
That's true.
Also.
Yep. And just to inform the public of what's happened recently, I met with our street supervisor. I said, what the heck can we do? I literally have grass growing in front of my house in the middle of the street. On cracks. Mm-hmm. So we haven't done any chip sealing, we haven't done any crack sealing, and we haven't done any pothole filling other than a hand shovel in the past 8 years. Very minimal. I shouldn't say any, very minimal. So with some real hard budget crunching, we were able to buy two pieces of equipment that arrived yesterday, and that is a Durapatcher and a crack sealer. The crack sealer goes and it just dribbles liquid tar on the cracks, and that keeps the water from getting in and the freeze thaw and the breakup. So that's exciting. And the Durapatcher spits out coated asphalt gravel, and it can actually fill those potholes. And then we have a thumper that will flatten it. So that machinery will allow many of our big potholes to get fixed. And I told Chet, our street supervisor, I want to see those pieces of equipment worn out. I want to see them running, you know, 5 days a week, maybe even at night. But at least that's a Band-Aid approach mm-hmm. to some of the really, you know, horrible streets that we're facing right now. I mean, people shouldn't have to swerve down every street they drive. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and then there's the city parking lot and beach parking lot. Those need some love too, but I'll let you drive this interview because
we could have you back for part two next week.
Absolutely.
Well, so we do want to talk about some other things, but that's the breaking news out of this show is that you're going to be asking for that local option tax.
Correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's, you know, things cost money. The local option tax. it imposed, you know, when we had it for Memorial Field, it imposed a one penny on every dollar spent. So if you buy $100 worth of grocery, it did add a dollar to your cost. But it raised all the money we were able to build Memorial Field and without hitting any other tax revenues. So,
right. And I've done four of these in my professional career with different municipalities. And what I found is that you need to really give the voters a carrot and you need to be true to your word. If you say you're going to do something, you need to do it. So you can't float some tax out there that's vague and we're going to do this, this, and this. It's going to be super specific we're going to get it done.
You know, I have a feeling no one's going to complain about getting the roads fixed up and really into the future by more infrastructure. And also technology will come in as we progress. There'll be new things and new ways of doing it.
Yeah, because we'll be in flying cars, so we won't even need the streets.
It comes down to a philosophy of what's the government's role in all this. And, you know, it's fine to have aspirations and visions and plans and help the private sector understand where you'd like to go, where the community wants to go. But my philosophy is government should provide, you know, basic services, water, sewer, fire, police, land use, building codes. So if we take care of our infrastructure, this is the most amazing country in the world, and our business, our private sector can do the rest. They can build housing. They can provide many other things that are needed, jobs, workforce. So that's really broadly where I'm focusing is let's just do what we should be doing, which is infrastructure. We don't need the housing authorities. We don't need, you know, a bunch of other things that the some governments get involved in. I'm a pretty basic meat and potato kind of guy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's talk about a few other things because we are going to run out of time and there's so much to talk about. So at City Beach, there's a new approach to discourage geese there, and that is to get folks that have dogs and get them qualified with their dog to be able to run off leash and chase the geese away. What's the update on that?
It's coming together. You know, this came out of a couple of things. One, I wasn't going to ever sign a paper that, you know, rounded up hundreds of geese and gassed them.
As happened under the previous
administration. So I told the folks who were very passionate about the lives of geese, come up with a solution. Don't complain. Tell me what's your solution. And credit to them, they did it. They came up with a plan. They've worked with community development director Jason Welker for a plan for certified dogs run by the private sector. They'll be vetted, make sure they're good dogs to do this. They will wear jackets and be identified, and they'll go out there and harass the geese. I was watching some geese the other day. A dog came within 100 yards, and they went right into the water. Mm-hmm. They do not like dogs, and they know it. So we're hopeful that will be effective, and they are working on that permitting and the process right now.
Do we have some dogs already in action at the beach?
I don't believe they're active at this point. Mm-hmm. They're still working on the vaccines and the rabies and, you know, the checkoff for certifying those dogs. But there are several groups of responsible dog owners that are interested in and participating in that. So, again, it's the private sector. It's our citizens stepping up to fill that void. And on that note with dogs, if you're not aware, we did just the council passed a change that will allow dogs on leashes in Travers Park on the pathway. It's really important that pet owners be responsible for picking up the waste of their dogs or those sorts of things will go away. So we really need people to pick up their dog waste. Mm-hmm. If you're out with a dog, you should have at least two bags so you can pick up your dog's and maybe an irresponsible dog owner's dog. So please be accountable for your dog waste.
Mm-hmm. So how do you enforce that? Because I walk Travers Park every day, and every day there's a dog off leash.
Yeah.
I haven't noticed any waste around, so hopefully they're doing that properly. But I don't know what to say because they come charging at me, and it's intimidating, but we can...
Yeah, signage, you know, we can do more with signage. Mm-hmm. We have something called community resource officers. Those we call them CROs for short. They're basically our ground level enforcers. They do parking. They do land use violations, weed violations, and they also enforce other codes like dogs off leash. So we can direct them to, you know, focus on areas, but that's the enforcement mechanism with penalties.
Or might maybe kindly ask the owner to put their dog on leash.
I think signage is helpful. We get a lot of visitors here who don't know, so.
Mm-hmm. I know Chris has more questions, but I wanted to go back to something you said really quickly. We have a new community development director.
Yes.
Jason Welker.
Correct.
Is it a new position? And if so, what is his, what's the mandate there?
Yes. Community planning and development director, Jason Welker, former city council president. So that was a new position. I did have that title when I worked for the city for 8 years, my final couple years. The goal is, it's new in the sense that it folds planning and some levels of building permit and parks and rec all under one director. Okay. We used to have a parks and rec director. When I talked earlier about my seven department heads, we used to have another one, parks and rec, Kim Woodruff. So I folded parks and rec under community planning and development. It's a big position. It manages all of our facilities, all of our parks, all of our park programming. It does all of our land use. He has two land use planners under him, all of our land use, all of our permitting, zoning. So it's a lot, and it's a position. The main reason that folding parks under there was to save money, so you don't have another department head salary as a parks and rec director. So it did put a lot on that position, but it's very, very important to have someone in that role.
So is that position involved with the comprehensive plan update?
Yes, all land use. So the comp plan, which the council had a workshop last week to finalize their preferred comments, and that will be coming to the council for adoption July 17th, that Wednesday.
So we're pretty close to being at the end of a process that's been years.
Three years long, Mm-hmm. So, once that comp plan is adopted, this is the most important document in any municipality or government. It sets the vision as established and confirmed by the residents of where we want to be in 10 or 20 years. What do we want more of? What do we want less of? And any individual council member, mayor, department head should be saying, it's not my vision, it's the vision of the comp plan. What is the comp plan? What do the residents want? So this is the guiding document for all city decisions moving forward. And once it's adopted, that position, Mr. Welker will jump right into the zoning changes. We're dealing with concerns about accessory dwelling units, the height, the bulk, the size of them. So they'll look at the residential zoning districts. We've heard a lot about our commercial zone, the height that's allowed, 65 feet right now downtown. There's concerns that may be too high with a couple of vacant properties and many active developers sniffing around downtown. There's thought that we may want to establish a historic district to protect the character and scale of our downtown.
So the historic buildings we have aren't totally overshadowed by massive new buildings.
Correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And our mountain views aren't completely
blocked out. That's right. The view sheds. So that's what will come after the comp plan is adopted. They'll get right into the zoning. And this may sound familiar because we did the same thing in 2009 when we adopted it, and then we revised all the zoning in town.
Where does someone go to read the comp plan and then maybe have input?
Yeah. If you go to the city website, you'll see master plans and documents, and it's right there. And then the input, we will hold a public hearing on third Wednesday of July. I believe it's the 17th. And at that time, the public can get up and criticize, make suggestions, endorse, and the council will have the decision to either approve the comp plan or pull it back for another special meeting to address those concerns.
Mm. What about someone submitting written comment?
Those are submitted and reviewed. They're received by the council and the planners, and those are prepared and presented to us as well.
Okay.
Well, before we run out of time, here's a issue that kind of bleeds over into a few of the things you've been talking about. So the Sandpoint Planning and Zoning Commission approved the plan for an Edgewater rebuild by Averill Hospitality last week. It's a recommendation to the city council.
No,
right?
No, it's a final decision.
It's the final decision. Yes. Okay. So they're good to go now.
They're good to go.
With the design phase of it. Yeah.
Yeah. So a conditional use permit is what they received in the commercial zone where that's located. There is a provision that says if your footprint, building footprint, is greater than 15,000 square feet, you need a conditional use permit. Mm-hmm. It's just a way to slow the process down so you don't get a very, very large building erected. So if they had just simply gone to 15,000 square foot and broken it into two buildings, they could have just pulled a building permit and gone away and started. So this was a process because their building is bigger than 15,000 square feet. They go through this conditional use permit process, and it allows the city to put conditions and reasonable stipulations on the project. So that has gone through. They now may proceed with those conditions applied. It's super exciting. This is a probably once in a generation moment. I call it the Hagedon moment for Sandpoint. If anyone was here in the 80s and saw Mr. Hagedon build the resort down in Coeur d'Alene, we all know the dramatic impact that had, the beneficial impact that had on their downtown. They're going to be investing, Averill's going to be investing, it looks like $70+ million into this building. It's going to have a 350-seat convention center. And that's going to be key because we miss out on so many regional and state events, the legislature, the fire folks, the planners, the water people, the sewer people, they all have these regional conferences in the state. And frequently it's, Post Falls, Coeur d'Alene, Lewiston, Boise, or Twin Falls, that's where they go. So
we don't currently have a facility that can handle that. Yeah.
So we'll probably see the Coachella Annual Mobile Summit expand. We'll see maybe De Hare, maybe Schweitzer. I was talking to the Lighthouse folks the other day. Maybe they'll have their national, gatherings here at the home where Lighthouse was created. So it's super exciting. That'll provide a bunch of benefits to the greater downtown and some new opportunities here.
Some questions that have come up that I've heard is with a 300 and some convention center and a 200 and some parking garage, what is the traffic look like? Because it's already a narrow little bridge. It's slow. You hit First Avenue. It's very congested. There will be times when it's a traffic situation.
Yeah.
Has that been addressed in this approved development?
It's been addressed a couple ways, and then there's more things we can do as well. First of all, they hired a traffic engineer, and they did something called a traffic impact study. That study runs a model and shows the flows based on traffic counts, and it's literally a computer model that shows little cars coming and turning and in addition, our city traffic consultant reviewed that. That study found that there's no need for additional improvements there. The other thing they've done is they're going to be doing valet parking. So, and they're going to have a bus. Many of their visitors are going to be arriving at the airport. They're going to have a daily bus down to the Spokane airport. So that might even help locals needing to go to the airport. Not all those people will have cars. And then the other thing we can do, the city beach parking lot I mentioned is, if you've driven down there, it's potholed, it's falling apart. I will be proceeding with a paid parking solution there. I don't know if that'll be this year or next year, but my goal there is to provide Sandpoint residents a very discounted parking rate in that parking facility, and then have market rate parking for visitors and non-city residents. And the goal there is to generate revenue to absolutely have the funds to actually pave that parking lot and keep it up. And as part of that, there's something called dynamic parking pricing, where we can put a sign up you know, at Bridge Street saying there's 5 open parking spaces or there's 10 open parking spaces or there's no open parking spaces. And that sign will hopefully let people know that don't bother coming down Bridge Street to the parking lot because there's no parking spaces. Mm-hmm. So hopefully we'll reduce some of the sort of the cruising where people are coming down looking for spaces when there are none.
We're down to about 2 minutes here. Can you give us a real brief update on Traverse Park? There's a bunch of stuff going on there. Yeah. The Concrete Lake Skate Park is under construction. There's a playground splash pad. And, of course, there's the James E. Russell Sports Center. Yes. How's everything going there?
You know, it's it's going as well as can be expected. The projects did not have a contingency. When you're building a house, you add an extra 10% in case something goes astray. We had no contingency in those budgets.
And a little bit went astray in terms of...
Yeah, there were some soil challenges that we all probably anticipated but weren't budgeted for. So the good news is they're all moving forward. We expect them to all be wrapped up this fall. The James E. Russell Center is expected to open prior to Thanksgiving. That's going to include tennis courts, pickleball. It's also a multi-use facility, so it will be available if people... eventually can walk it, do walking laps and inclement weather. The big challenge with that is we've never run an indoor facility. So we're working with some folks who do this professionally in terms of the rates, the time blocks, the even the staff to manage and clean and take reservations. We're going to do a lot online so you can reserve and block courts online. But it's going to be, I think, a very well-used and appreciated facility. And certainly thank the Russells for their donation. It's been a difficult project. Anyone who's followed it knows that. And I think we've learned a lot about how not to do a project.
How not to get one started, at
least. That's right.
Yeah.
But no, so. It's going to be a big improvement. And I guess I'd say, you know, as far as the budget, barring... other multi-million dollar donations. Unfortunately, I don't see a lot of big park projects in the budget in the next 3.5 years.
Mm. Due to those infrastructure needs.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, Mayor Jeremy Grimm, thank you for taking this time to talk with us and fill us in. We covered a lot of territory there. And yet there's so much more to talk about. So we will get you back in a couple months,
anytime.
6 weeks or something like that, and try to keep people informed with all the stuff going on with the city.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And if any public member of the public has questions, I'm at City Hall Tuesdays through Thursdays. So please email, call, or stop by, and I'm probably able to come out and answer your questions.
Thank you, Mayor Grimm, very much. That website for the Sandpoint is sandpointidaho.gov, in case you want to go check out the very informative website and look at that comprehensive plan. And be involved. It makes a difference, I'm sure.